Pakistan declared itself the world's first Islamic democracy when it became an Islamic Republic in 1956, about 9 years after it gained independence from British rule. But the current political climate there and throughout the Middle East has caused some to question whether there can ever be true Islamic democracies in the modern world. Shahan Mufti, however, argues that the situation is not hopeless, and in his new memoir, The Faithful Scribe, The Story of Islam, Pakistan, Family, and War, he traces his family tree back 1,400 years to reveal Pakistan's long, complicated history with religion, modernity, and tradition. It's published by Other Press, and I'm very pleased that it has brought Shahan Mufti to our show today. Hello.
Hi.
Now, you were born in the United States.
That's right.
When did your family come here?
Oh, my father moved here. Well, it's family history that gets tied up with political history, but this was Cold War, and so this was the 1960s that my father ended up in Ohio as a PhD student.
At Case?
At Case Western, yeah.
Now, why Cleveland? All school places to go.
Well, this was a time when the United States was reaching out to anybody in Asia to counter Soviet influence. So Pakistan obviously was right near the Soviet Union. It was separated by a few hundred miles. And India at that time was squarely in the Soviet camp. And so the United States and Pakistan became very close at that time. And so this was just an American scholarship given to Pakistani students. And they had to put them wherever they could find
space.
And
what was he studying?
He was in the medical school.
You've lived back and forth between Pakistan and the United States. Do you think that gives you, as a journalist, a better perspective on the situation?
Well, yeah. I mean, the perspective was part of the big drive in this. I knew I had a certain perspective, which I knew was not something that everybody shared. And that was not just being a journalist, an American journalist. That was also being between Pakistan and the United States, just having my feet in both worlds. And like I describe in the book, I've split my time equally in both places. But I've shuttled back and forth constantly. So I'd seen, even in the last 12 years of this war, so I saw very up close and how the narratives of this war and the reality of this war was developing on each side.
And do you think the people on both sides have only a superficial understanding of the complexities of the situation?
Well, yeah, superficial, and in sometimes I describe them in the book as caricatures. So they are based in reality, but with whatever picture develops on either side, it ends up exaggerating certain features and then diminishing others, and it ends up looking very strange.
Now, when you began thinking about writing this book, did you think of writing it as a memoir, or were you trying to talk about family history, a history of religion and politics in Pakistan?
Well, the family history came later. I knew I wanted to tell this story. I wanted a large account. I was working as a daily news reporter in Pakistan. And I landed there at a time when this conflict in Pakistan and the United States involvement in Pakistan was getting pretty deep. So this is around 2007. And I knew immediately that I wanted to tell this story, maybe in the form of a book even. But it was really... it was when I came across the family history, which was very fascinating to me and new to me.
And you could trace your family history back to the tribe of the Prophet Muhammad?
That's right. This is my family. So I was in Pakistan. Again, I was reporting the war. And during this time, I think it was right around the time, actually, that President Obama spoke in Egypt and he addressed the Muslim world. And I remember clearly it was around that time that I came across this scroll in my late grandfather's old stuff. And it was a pretty large scroll, the size of my torso almost, and it was very frail and brown, yellowing paper, and I could tell it was centuries old. And it was on that scroll of paper that I found my maternal family's history written, and it did lead right into the inner circle of the Islamic Prophet Muhammad and to one of his closest aides, Umar.
Well, how did your ancestors wind up in the Indian subcontinent, pretty far from Saudi Arabia?
Well, that story was covered in the family tree. So this family tree was accompanied with the book, which explained, obviously had to explain somehow, go to the trouble of explaining how this 1,400 years of history is unfolded. And there was one person in particular that the family tree wrote that described his story, and he was in Iraq. Along the Euphrates he lived, and then this Tamerlane, this old Central Asian emperor who once occupied all this land between the Middle East and South Asia. It was he had an encounter with this ancestor of mine, supposedly, in the story. And he's the one who moved him to the Indus, which is present-day Pakistan. And so this one character, and I found his grave, actually, which dated back to the 13th century during the research of this book. And it was just amazing to see that it existed.
Moved him to the Punjab?
To the Punjab. Yes, exactly.
Both of your parents are college graduates. At the time, were women encouraged to pursue a higher education in Pakistan?
No, not at all. My mother was exceptional in this regard. So the book begins with my parents both getting their higher degree education, my father in the United States and my mother in Pakistan. You see the kind of contradiction, because my mother at that time did wear the niqab, so she was covered up in a very traditional and conservative Islamic style, but she wanted to do her PhD in economics. In the end, she did get her master's. She didn't get a PhD, but it was unusual, and she was the first woman in her family to get a higher degree education.
Your name, Mufti, has significance as well. Mm-hmm. To me, Mufti refers to when someone is dressed in civilian clothes, even though he normally wears a uniform. Yeah. But it has another meaning in Arabic?
Well, it's a related meaning, actually. It's derived from the same word. But Mufti, which is my last name, is an Arabic word for the one who gives a fatwa. So Mufti give fatwas. And fatwa is a word that a lot of your listeners will be more familiar with. It's an Islamic decree. It's an opinion that an Islamic scholar of religion and law can give based on his or her knowledge of Islamic law. So this is a name that I inherited from my father's side. From my mother's side, actually, her family name was Qazi, which is also an Islamic bureaucratic title, and Qazis are the judges in Islamic courts. So I had this very interesting history which tied my paternal side and my maternal side to these bureaucratic titles in Islamic history, which were which existed all the way between Europe and Asia at one time, but no longer do.
And this is all in administering Sharia law?
Yes. So this is all the running of Islamic legal systems and courts.
Now, in Pakistan, until Zia-ul-Haq took over as the military dictator, the laws were pretty much based on the British system. He changed it to Sharia law.
To some extent, even he wasn't able to obviously bring about any revolutionary change in his. But yes, Pakistan was born, and this is something I do talk about in my book and try to unpack in my book, of how Pakistan was the legal system in Pakistan is really created by it's an amalgamation of the British, Western common law inherited from British colonial rule of centuries. And this Islamic law that Pakistan wants to trace its roots back to. And so Pakistan was really that first country where these two laws managed to meld, and Pakistan became the world's first Islamic democratic republic. And so it's not no accident that this happened in Pakistan.
But 9 years after it was independent, India declared itself a democracy immediately. What took Pakistan so long, and what was it a kind of a military rule?
Well, no. Pakistan came up with its first constitution in 1956, and it did take 9 years to come up with the first constitution. But it was the world's first Islamic democratic constitution. There was no blueprint for Pakistan to follow. This was really blazing a trail, the stuff that Pakistan did. And that's part of the reason, and in my book I point to this pretty specifically, that this is really in some ways at the roots of Pakistan's problems, even the very contemporary problems that we see. This tension between how to mix Western ideals of democracy with Islamic ideals it's still a project that's ongoing.
And also the whole concept of nationhood becomes an issue. In the case of Pakistan, it became more complicated because there was also East Pakistan, which eventually broke free and became Bangladesh. Mm-hmm. But in both cases, Pakistan involved cutting right through the Punjab, even though there's a Punjabi culture that's shared by Hindus and Muslims, and cutting right through Bengal, which is a culture that is shared by both Muslims and Hindus. The British, it seems to me, should be blamed for all of the problems that we see in the Indian subcontinent.
That's always easy. But you're absolutely right that this idea of nationhood and how it was created, and especially Muslim nationhood in South Asia, is it's a phenomenal experiment. And it did. It went against some basic logic at times. What we were used, I mean, you know, the world was used to an idea of nationhood, of people tied together either by language or their ethnicities, or, you know, there were some basic parameters for nationalism. And this fell apart in South Asia under British colonial rule. And the Muslims, who ran across ethnic lines, decided that they were a separate nation that deserved a separate state.
But wasn't partition a near disaster? Not only did it slice Punjab and Bengal down the middle, but many died going from India to the new Pakistan and going from Pakistan to India.
Absolutely. This is one of the bloodiest episodes of in recorded history, really, but definitely of the 20th century. The people say about, you know, over about a dozen million, 12 to 20 million people moved during this time. Estimates of about 2 million people died in riots and just violence that accompanied this movement. People were leaving their homes and just traveling sometimes a few miles across an imaginary new line on the map. And so this is extremely bloody history, and it really has left deep scars, which we see in the relationship between India and Pakistan today.
And ironically, until fairly recently, India was the second most populous Muslim nation in the world after Indonesia. I think Pakistan has finally surpassed it.
I think so. It's the census figures are debated on each side, especially in India, because some people believe the Muslims' population is bigger there still than it is in Pakistan. But it wasn't a clean break at all. There's still more or as many Muslims in India as there are in Pakistan.
My guest is Shahan Mufti. His book, The Faithful Scribe, A Story of Islam, Pakistan, Family, and War, published by Other Press. Your father was going to an American college at the time of a lot of turmoil in this country because of the Vietnam War. Were there protests Case Western Reserve?
He was right about to finish his doctoral degree when the Kent State the students died at Kent State.
Not far at all,
about 40 miles, I think, north of Cleveland. So this was he was deeply affected by what he saw in the United States during the Vietnam War. But he didn't expect that as soon as he would return to Pakistan, the Cold War would follow him there when the Soviets invaded Afghanistan.
And then there was, he returned in the early 70s, right?
To Lahore, yeah.
That was around the time the conflict broke out between India and Pakistan in 1971.
So this is where the story in the book begins. But this is when the eastern half that you were talking about, the eastern half of Pakistan was starting to break free from the western half of Pakistan to become the separate country of Bangladesh. And this was it was during this war, actually. It was the first day of the aerial bombing of the city of Lahore, where both my parents were, by the Indians, that my parents were trying to get married on the ground. It was also the first day they'd met each other, actually. So this was the story begins. But in many ways, Pakistan's contemporary story begins at that moment as well, because it became a brand new state. It lost half of its population, almost half of its land. And
people blame it for having caused that situation. The people of Bangladesh said that they were really oppressed by the people of West Pakistan.
Mm-hmm. So this is very tense history in the country. But Bangladesh celebrates this war as their war of independence. And for Pakistan, it was a civil war in which the country broke into two.
And it is still involved in a war over Kashmir with India.
Yes, so the territorial boundaries are still very contested.
Now, has Pakistan been under military rule for much of its history since 1956, even though it's ostensibly a democracy? Even in times of democracy, hasn't the military maintained a lot of political and economic power?
Very true. I think it's about half and half now, is that the 60-odd years, 70, almost 70 years, actually, that Pakistan's been an independent country. The military is ruled for about half of that. But at the same time, Pakistan, because we're talking about this country that was established as a democracy and inherited this whole British idea of democracy from the British colonial rule, the institutions and the seeds of democracy are it's amazing. They are still strong enough that we see dictators getting toppled every time they come in less than a decade. They're
gone. But if your name is Bhutto, you don't want to run for political office.
Well, they still are. They surprisingly so.
Zulfikar Ali Bhutto was the prime minister and founder of the Pakistan People's Party, and then was executed in 1979. And Benazir, of course, was assassinated in 2007, which suggests that it's kind of dangerous to be a political leader in Pakistan.
It is. And just the history speaks for itself. The amount of, just the numbers of assassinations, even actually, this is painful history, that the park, the rally ground where Benazir Bhutto was shot and murdered was actually named after the first prime minister of Pakistan, who was also assassinated in that same park. And so it's a bloody history of politics in Pakistan.
Another constant is constant charges of corruption.
Yeah.
But that's not unique to Pakistan either.
Yeah, it's not unique to Pakistan at all. The political elite in the country, and I talk about this towards the end of my book, is what the roots of all this. And the political elite in Pakistan grows from a very specific kind of landed elite in the country, who have a deep stake in keeping some of the colonial structures alive while touting Islamic rule. And it becomes really problematic, and the internal logic really doesn't hold often.
We went back and forth between the United States and Pakistan, but did you find that things were different after 9/11?
Yes, I was in Vermont at college, actually, when the 9/11 happened. And my life obviously changed after that. I tell the story in the book of the day after 9/11 when I got a phone call from a federal agent inquiring about how I was doing. But it got me thinking.
What, were they suspicious of you? Well, or were they worried for your health?
I think they sounded like they were worried for my health, but I think they might have been interested in other things.
Well, do people in Pakistan see you as Pakistani or as an American who... to some degree was an outsider.
I do. I mean, I say in the book that I'm 100% Pakistani and 100% American, and I do feel that. These are two identities that I completely inhabit simultaneously, and that gives me the. I mean, nobody in Pakistan ever notice it or assume that I'm from anywhere else when I'm there. But at the same time, it gives me that, having lived a lot and looked at Pakistan from the outside and having looked at it from the U.S., it gives me that outsider perspective that maybe not everybody else has. And that's the perspective I was talking about that I knew I had.
Well, does it also cause you to have divided loyalties? Because, for example, just recently, a drone strike killed perhaps the most hated Taliban leader, and you would have thought, since the Taliban has caused so much trouble for Pakistan, that everybody would have celebrated. Instead, it has become a major source of political tension between the two countries.
It's very interesting that you say this, Leonard, because divided loyalties, it's almost, I think, what we need right now between the United States and Pakistan is some honesty and openness to look at where each country is coming from. There's a lot of deceit going on in this relationship. But I think there's also a lot of dishonesty going on between each government and its own people in describing the cooperation and the relationship between these two countries. So I think there are a lot of times when the government give us a certain narrative, when actually in the truth the cooperation is real and actually sometimes obscured on purpose.
Well, you mentioned the Cold War. Mm-hmm. Something similar was happening in Iran until the Islamic Revolution, where we supported the Shah and the Savak and all the rest, simply because the enemy of my enemy is my friend. And the same thing was happening in Pakistan, also because of the United States dealings with India. So the United States has warmer relations with India. Has that affected our situation with Pakistan?
The relationship with India, obviously, after the end of the Cold War has really changed, and the United States is more and more looking to India as a partner. But with Pakistan, it's just ever since Pakistan came on the map in 1947, the United States and Pakistan have been tied together I'm perpetually, it seems, in geopolitics, in what every decade something seems to happen to pull the two countries closer.
Even though in Afghanistan, mm-hmm. Pakistan is often accused of being a major problem.
Absolutely. And at the same time, Pakistan is the one that's allows the United States to carry this war out. And this is the kind of the geopolitics that I'm talking about, is that we have Iran and Afghanistan on one border, and then we have India and China on the eastern border of Pakistan. This is a neighborhood that the United States is not going to extract itself from. And Pakistan happens to sit right in the middle of it.
If I were to go to Pakistan and take a poll, mm-hmm. would I find out that they're our wide range of opinions about all of this?
Well, that's funny because this poll's been taken very recently. As far as domestic politics goes, yes. But as far as the United States goes, it's very sad that in both countries, two recent polls actually, one showed that one of the countries most hated in the United States or most disliked in the United States is Pakistan, along with North Korea and Iran. And the most disliked country in Pakistan is the United States. And these are pretty overwhelming figures. It's amazing that these figures are coming from two countries that are supposedly allies in a war and have been allied and been on the same side of most political events of the last 60 years. There's something missing here, and there's something that goes wrong.
Well, as a journalist, do you see this as a problem of the way the story is being told, or is it the way governments are talking to their people?
I think it's both. You know, there's this great line in Michael Ayer's dispatches and about his book about Vietnam, where he talks about this this idea of communications pudding, and how the conventional journalism was turning a profound event in American history into communications pudding. And sometimes I feel like that. I've covered this war for 7 years now as a journalist. And
you're talking about the war on terrorism?
Well, yes, the conflict in Pakistan, the so-called war on terrorism from the front lines in Pakistan. And sometimes I will read the morning paper and my head will spin because it is so difficult to tell who this new head of this new group is and what they want and how does this help the United States and how does this hurt another. It's impossible to unpack this stuff. And I think that while there's a lot of information, there's very little understanding. And that's what my aim in writing this book was, because I think that what we really lack is not information but the understanding of what the other country is.
Well, we have very little time, but mm-hmm. the reason I asked you about Pakistani attitudes is it's my sense that the country is divided to some degree. The area along the Afghan border is quite different from Lahore.
Absolutely. Yeah. There's
or Islamabad.
And this divide between the city and the backwaters, obviously, but also just this divide between just the different ethnicities in Pakistan is a huge strain on the country. But they're all supposed to be held together by Islam.
And different languages, in fact.
Absolutely.
Shahan Mufti will be speaking tonight at 6 at the NYU Journalism Institute. That's at 20 Cooper Square on the 7th floor. His book, The Faithful Scribe, A Story of Islam, Pakistan, Family, and War, is published by Other Press. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me, Leonard.